I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The Orlando Film Festival is heading into its 8th year in Central Florida, this year showcasing over 200 films from around the world. I'll speak with filmmaker and executive director Dan Springen about the growth of the festival and the commercial and independent film industry here in Central Florida. Also, student filmmaker Stephen Carlson joins me to talk about making the short film Stringer, which is an entry in this year's film festival. Well, that's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Dan Springen. Dan is the executive director of the Orlando Film Festival, which is held in Orlando October 16th to the 20th and hosts independent films from all over the globe, including a fair smattering from Central Florida. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
The film festival is heading into its 8th year in Central Florida. Is it growing in size? What's the status of film in this part of Florida?
Yeah, in 8 years, I've watched this festival grow into it's getting to the place to where we can really jump off and make it the monster that we've all envisioned that it would eventually be become. When I first came on as the executive director, we got into the Plaza Cinema Cafe. It's now the Cobb Plaza Cinema Cafe. We had 4 theaters this year after having a conversation with Jeremy Wellman from Cobb Theaters. They went back and looked at their books from last year and realized that we had generated so much revenue, so much more revenue than they would normally have on that particular weekend any given year, that they decided to give us 2 more theaters, which basically what that means is almost overnight we went to almost 50% bigger. And the reason I say that is because now we instead of 140 films that we had last year, we're now showing 220. We have more time to program because we have more theaters, which means filmmakers.
Is that a good thing, though? I mean, is there a point at which you become a victim of your own success and you get too big?
You know, that sounds like a high class problem to me. Right now, in 8 years, we're not a Tribeca. You know, we're not a South by Southwest. We're not a Cannes Film Festival. You know, we're not showing thousands of films. But I'll tell you what we are is we're Orlando. And what's nice about Orlando is it's a household name. So once the festival has grown in scope from a business sense, not just how many people we can bring to town, but from a business sense, and we're actually running the festival correctly, and we have the right sponsors, and we have the amount of money to pay for the staff and pay for the things that we need for the festival, then we can grow outside of that 220 films. I envision, and so do the other partners in the film festival, our board members, we envision seeing that this festival will one day grow outside of the Plaza Cinema Cafe and out into surrounding areas to where the entire city is celebrating film at one time, and it's not just centrally located in downtown. And that's tens of thousands of people, and that will be, you know, hundreds more films than what we have already.
And, I mean, I know that in Orlando, they're always talking about how do we bring more people back to the core of the city. You know, there's been this, I guess, fear of people flying to the outlying shopping malls, things like that, and the city becoming kind of hollowed out. Do you think this can really bring people back into that central city?
I know it can, and I've seen it. The weekend that we're downtown at the festival and we're putting the festival on, you see just massive amounts of people in and around the downtown area. And I basically work from our centrally located office in downtown Orlando at the Cobb Plaza Cinema Cafe on the cinema floor. And while I'm down there, I'm engaging with downtown business leaders, downtown companies, vendors who are downtown. And I see the traffic patterns. But when we open our doors on the 16th, from the 16th through the 20th, you see hundreds more people just scattered about and going into the shops, obviously seeing our films, which is what we want, but we also want economic development. One of the things that we understand, but we don't really stand on a soapbox about, is the political nature of film festivals. I'm a filmmaker to begin with. I mean, I'm a DGA director, Directors Guild of America director. I've produced 8 films into worldwide distribution. And I understand the plight of the filmmaker. So when they come into town, for me, it's my goal and my staff's goal to make them feel wanted, trusted, Like they've done a service to community, not that they're cattle and they're a number and they're a statistic so that they can go to their bigger corporate sponsors and get more money because they have more impressions. I understand that that's a part of it, but that's not the way that we run our festival. Our festival is ran for filmmakers by filmmakers. The political side of it, we understand that it has to happen. We understand the economic development, and we want our folks to come in and spend money downtown and bring the people, bring that core, bring people from all outlying areas down into downtown so they can check out our movies. But at the same time, make everybody feel comfortable that this isn't some stuffy, stuffed shirt, highbrow event. I'm not saying it's lowbrow, but it's cool. Movie Maker Magazine will announce their top 25 coolest festivals in the world. And we know that we landed somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't announced what slot we have, but we know that we're somewhere in the top 25 coolest film festivals in the world. And that's because the filmmakers love us.
One of the coolest film festivals in the world. Is that something you would have foreseen 5 years ago?
I don't want to be, you know, cocky, but yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because as a filmmaker, I've been to a lot of film festivals, and a lot of times you just feel like you're shuttled around and you never get to meet the executive director, let alone have a beer with him or sit down and grab a burger downstairs. You know, I do so much pre-production for the festival that when the festival hits, I'm able to hang out with the filmmakers like we're hanging out in here and just shoot the breeze, have a beer, you know, and we hang out. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not like hidden in the background like a lot of festivals. There's this big corporate facade on some of these bigger festivals where you just don't get to be engaged by the people who actually put it on. It's like you show up and then figure out what to do. We're engaged every day of the festival. We have a party for our filmmakers every day. We have a cocktail hour. We have panels where we bring in professionals to talk to them. So we just try and make it we try and make it unstuffy.
Let me ask you too about the entries, because you must get a lot of entries, and if you've expanded the range of films you can actually show from 150 to 220, that's a bigger slice of film real estate that people can actually get their films out there. How many more entries are you getting this year?
This year we brought Jerry Cavallaro. He's a young filmmaker I met 5 years ago, and he's come to the festival every single year. But we actually named an award after him because he was such a go-getter. We called it the Jerry Cavallaro Independent Spirit Award. And every year we changed the name of it to the filmmaker that wins it that year. But it started with Jerry, and we created this award for him because he just came in and he worked hard. Well, and I'm actually getting to a point. Jerry, what I saw in Jerry was that I thought he would make the perfect advisory board member of our team to take on social media and to take on the submissions. And just to give you an idea, last year, 2012, we had 214 submissions through Without a Box. And of those 214, like 185 or 186 of the Without a Box. Now, we get a lot of entries that come from outside of Without a Box. But of that group, only like 186 sent their films in and actually paid their fee. With us this year, we had over 404.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry could tell you better, but we had a 404. So that's almost a 100% increase just by bringing this one go-getter guy onto the team. So we couldn't be more happy with the work that Jerry's done. Submissions are up. In a year where submissions are down at a lot of other festivals, including Tribeca, you take the Orlando Film Festival and almost doubles their film submissions. Who knows? Maybe we were doing it wrong in the past, and maybe we weren't living up to our potential, and Jerry just got us there. But I like to believe that Jerry, you know, is the answer to our submissions, because he's a filmmaker himself and helped us to really drive films into the queue so that we would mm-hmm. be able to choose as many films that we could play that had good production value, good stories, and good acting, good directing, production design, et cetera. As filmmakers who look at the films and decide, this group can look and see if a film has good production value and knows what they're looking at.
What about the idea of bigger scale commercial film production? Do you see this boom, I guess, if there is a boom in independent film and smaller scale production going on in Central Florida, can that help spur some sort of boom in bigger scale productions coming to Central Florida, do you think?
You know, it can. And this is a, you know, as a filmmaker, looking outside, I wear a couple hats. You know, I'm the Orlando film. I'm the executive director of Orlando Film Festival, but I'm also a filmmaker. I'm a producer, and there's a few things that are happening right now within our community that's kind of a drag. And I guess maybe it's a high class problem, but we had $275 million that was part of a tax incentive to bring films to Florida, not just Central Florida, but Florida.
Sure.
That money goes out to films from wherever. If you come from Los Angeles and you want to make your film in Central Florida, you sign up, you get in a queue line. If you have $1 million film, you can get 20% tax credit, up to 25% if it's family friendly. And what ended up happening was, because there were such monster shows that were happening down in Miami, they ate up that amount of money all the way through 2016. So, and I want to say 2015, but the moral of the story is that money's gone. And what happens these days in filmmaking is everyone looks, every single film that's going to be made, they look at how much they're going to get in tax incentive where they go. Starting in Vancouver, Alberta, they look at New Mexico, they look at Louisiana, they look at Georgia. And the thing about it is, they will make a set in Georgia look like Florida. They'll make a set in Vancouver look like New York City. Why do they do that? Because they're getting so much money back. Imagine if you have a $10 million budget and you're getting 20% back in a tax credit that you can sell at 93 cents on the dollar. That's a lot of money. That's plenty of money to build a set and make it happen. Well, in Florida right now, we are without that tax incentive. One of the heads in production for Disney, I was at a conference not 3 weeks ago. I was at a conference with a lot of legislatures from the state of Florida, and the whole thing was about tax incentives. And one of the heads of production of Disney said, we don't even look at Florida right now. This is Disney. They're here. They're in our backyard. They don't even look at us as a viable place to shoot a movie. Why? There's no tax incentive money left.
And that's Florida tax?
All Florida. It's the Florida film tax incentive. And there's been a lot of people who've been, you know, right there at the forefront of the initiative. Paul Sermons, who was our Florida film commissioner at one time, helped to draw up the legislation, helped to draw up all the information for this tax incentive, because for a while we didn't even have it. We had runaway production. It was leaving and going to Canada, leaving, going to Louisiana, because you could go there and get 25%, I think it was 25% cash back on everything. Not just expenditures, on everything from your director to your stars that came out of L.A. They're taking that money back to L.A. Our system was great, and it was working great, and we were bringing bigger shows in. Like down in Miami, you had the Glades. You had Magic City, Burn Notice. You know, big television shows that gobbled up all that money.
Do you have the ear of lawmakers? I mean, you mentioned you're at a meeting with some Florida lawmakers a little while back. Do you have a sympathetic ear from them in terms of maybe getting some new tax credits or getting some more incentives to get film back into Florida?
Yeah, that's exactly what that whole meeting was about. There were 24 legislators that were in from all different districts around the state of Florida, and they came in to hear this very eloquent speech from multiple people very high up in the film industry here in Florida, talk about the film tax incentives and why we need them here, including Disney. I mean, if that didn't wake up the people in Florida that Disney isn't even looking at us. Disney isn't looking at our state to shoot movies because we don't have tax incentive. They were all there. Now, whether they were listening or not, I don't know. Whether they're going to act or not, I have no idea. But Film Florida, which is a great organization, I think it's filmflorida.org. You can read more about it on their website, but they're really the champions for all of us in the industry to lobby and to talk to the senators and talk to the people in Washington and get this whole thing figured out, get Florida back on track.
You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking with Dan Springen, Executive Director of the Orlando Film Festival. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or Twitter. You can also email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Well, let me cycle back to independent film, and I guess a question about the number of entries you've had. I'm just wondering if the kind of boom in the number of entries you had for your film festival also has something to do with the fact that it's easier to get off-the-shelf filmmaking equipment and programs and things these days?
The answer is absolutely. Look, when I came up in this game, it was 35mm film, 16, Super 16, and that's all you had. Mm-hmm. That's all you shot. The video, the quality of video, you had VHS, Super VHS, and then you had Beta. But nobody shot feature films on that because you couldn't crush the depth of field. It just didn't have that cinematic look. It didn't have that beauty. But nowadays, you can get off-the-shelf DSLR cameras, you know, from a T2i to a 7D or a 5D. A lot of professional film outfits run with 5Ds because, I mean, it's 1080p, super high quality, interchangeable single lens reflex lenses that you can put right on the front of the camera, crush your depth of field and get that, you know, and roll it 30 frames or 24 frames per second and actually get that beautiful cinematic imagery. Mm-hmm. That you could never get from video before. So literally, I could go out and I could make a feature film, own the equipment for about $10,000. You could never get away with that back in the day, not in film, because then you had to go through processing, work prints, then cutting your negative, and then, I mean, it's a beautiful process, don't get me wrong. And I was talking with some of the filmmakers on set today. I was on a commercial, and we were talking about the old days, and the students never get that anymore. They never get taught how to edit on a steamback, on a flatbed editing system. Nobody ever touches celluloid anymore. Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, we get more submissions. Do we get the same quality submissions? Not necessarily. When people are going through the process of actually shooting on film, and they're spending $1,000 for a 1,000-foot load of 35mm film, and then you have to process it. Then you have to get it transcoded into a digital system so you can bring it into your nonlinear editing system anyway, to then spit it back out to a work print to cut it on a... The process now is so... That process to all of us now is so clunky that only the true purists really, really do it, or people with enormous budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to see a lot of films during the time leading up to the Orlando Film Festival. And it's surprising how many beautiful entries you get because people are shooting on this inexpensive equipment, like the Red, the Alexa. I mean, the Alexa isn't inexpensive, nor is the Red. But in comparison to a big 35mm Panasonic gold camera with, you know, now you have to have five mags and... The system has just changed so much, you know? It mm-hmm. used to be, you know, you had what was called a clapper loader, the guy who goes out with the sticks, okay, it's at market, boom, they clap. And then they would go and they'd run and then they'd change a mag over, take it out, get it ready to go to the lab. None of that happens anymore. They have what's called a DIT. And that's the person that sits back and they're in charge of getting the card from the camera, putting it into a hard drive, then downloading it, transcoding it so it's ready to go into editing, and it's all done on a laptop right on set. You know, it's a very streamlined system now, and you still get the high quality production value that you used to in 35 because you can crush the depth of field with these big chip cameras with interchangeable lenses. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot more because the equipment is inexpensive and people can still turn out great product. But at the same time, I don't think as much care always goes into what's ending up on or in the scene, because when you're rolling film, it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm. You obviously have, though, enough high quality stuff that you can show 220 great films in your festival.
Yeah. That's the beauty of having a film festival for filmmakers by filmmakers, because we actually have people looking at the films who have knowledge of production value. It's not about, okay, let's just find the artsiest thing we can, man, and put that on the screen. People love it. They'll come from all over the world to see it. You know, sometimes you have your artsy films. I'm not, you know, busting on artsy films. You got to have those. But even the artsy films can have good production value. Some people will send in stuff. You'll see a guy leaning against a tree doing a monologue. And, you know, it's like his sister's holding the camera. And, you know, God bless him for trying, you know. But I think, you know, The message is that if you're going to spend the $30, $40, $50 to get into a film festival, spend a little time reviewing films that you want your film to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Then try and use your own touch, your own flair to give some good production value and get them in. With our films, We have everything from young filmmakers, 12, 13, 14. And we take that into account, too. We have a student short program. So students, you know, we give a little bit more of a pass to. But a lot of times you'll see these student films are just as good, if not better, than the best short films that we get in. Because they're getting the education. They're getting good education at great film schools, mm-hmm. like Valencia Community College, by the way.
Right. And that's not the only one. Of course, you've got Full Sail, you've got UCF, which I understand kind of birthed the team that created the Blair Witch Project, which I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not. But
it's certainly good for independent film.
Mm-hmm.
And also Ralph Clemente from Valencia Community College also taught some of those guys. So they got kind of dual education. And yeah, I mean, look, Blair Witch, it was a phenomenon. They did it. Right at the right time. You know, the web presence was growing. They had a good contact into Sundance, and then it just took off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took off. And the thing too is that for a while there were a lot of independent filmmakers that were like, well, you know, help me, just get me some money. I mean, look what happened with Blair Witch. I mean, we can duplicate this. Nobody's been able to duplicate it. They've had a little bit of that luck with a couple, you know, Open Water had mm-hmm. some, you know, and even the Paranormal Activity, you know, the first one, it kind of felt like that whole handycam thing. And a lot of people still shoot films like that. They're documentary style, but it's really narrative, you know. And we see a lot of those, and we play some, but we don't, you know, we don't instantly give films like that a nod. You know, I mean, everything gets, if our features get 15 minutes, we'll watch your feature for 15 minutes.
Right.
Short films, they'll get 10, up to 10 minutes. And that's it. And if you can cut the mustard, we'll watch it the rest of the way. But I mean, if after 15 minutes we notice that your lighting is subpar, your acting or your directing, it comes out of the queue.
Well, let me ask you this: what films are on your must-see list this year at this festival?
There's a few that I just absolutely wouldn't miss. We have our opening night film is called Chasing Shakespeare. That'll be playing two nights during the festival. And by the way, you can go to OrlandoFilmFest.com or OrlandoFilmFestival.com and see all of the films. You'll see trailers from many of them. You'll see our event schedule, etc. And opening night film is Chasing Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
This is it's a beauty. It stars Danny Glover and Graham Greene, and it incorporates a lot of different artistic elements into the picture. Then we have the Thomas Dolby Experience. If you remember Thomas Dolby from the 80s, he blinded you with science. That's going to be happening Sunday. He has a new film out called The Invisible Lighthouse. We've got wonderful short programs. We have I Am Eco, which is a group that's coming in, headed by Laura Seidel Turner, so Ted Turner's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's coming into town to do a keynote presentation for the I Am Eco group, and that is on Saturday.
It's a party.
It's a party every single day of the week,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not one of those parties where, you know, it's a bunch of stuffed shirts. It's really everybody having a good time, letting their hair down, relaxing and celebrating independent cinema.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Dan Springen. He's the executive director of the Orlando Film Festival, which is in Orlando, October 16th through the 20th, and hosts independent films from all over the globe. Dan, thanks very much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure.
Up next, a conversation with Stephen Carlson about his film Stringer, a short documentary about a late-night freelance cameraman.
This is wildlife in its own way. This is people misbehaving. Society misbehaving.
We're going to go talk to that woman who's willing to talk on video. She knows what happened.
The less the cops see you on scene, the better. Like, ideally, you don't even want them to know you're there.
You tell me we had two similar stories.
I'm joined in the studio by Stephen Carlson. Stephen is a film student at Full Sail University. He's the director of photography for the short film Stringer, which looks at the life of a late-night freelance cameraman. Stephen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, tell me about this film Stringer. What made you pick the life of a late-night freelance cameraman as the subject for a film?
When we took the class, documentary filmmaking, we were discussing ideas for, you know, what we could do it on. And one of our classmates was an instructor for one of the other months going through the program again, and he knew the subject of the documentary, Stephen Fernandez, through another guy he knew out of school, and he said, you know, it's interesting. We, you know, you can look at it and see what you guys think. And I'll talk to him and see if he's cool with it. And once he said that, it started rolling and everybody got more and more excited about it. Mm-hmm. And he got really excited about it too. And he was like, yeah, we can come out with me and I can take you guys out on a ride on a night. And he set up an interview with his mom and everybody. And he said we can get in touch with the news stations that he talks to and maybe a couple cops too, see how he interacts with them.
Is it kind of a strange life? I mean, making this documentary, did you get the sense that it was a slightly offbeat career for somebody to pursue, or maybe something a little out of the ordinary?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, as Full Sail students, we can relate to the ridiculous hours, but even to us, it seemed, you know, a crazy life to live, mm-hmm. you know, constantly being around police scanner waiting for calls and, you know, being up all night, all weekends, but he likes it. It's fun.
How did you go about making this? Did you just say to yourself, okay, I'm going to spend like a week to see what their life is like? How did that work?
More or less, we got equipment from the school that we rented out. And so we would go with him around 8 or 9 o'clock, meet up with him. He would go to a few locations around Orlando that he liked to wait out with. And we'd just hang out with him and wait for a call. And it was kind of boring at times just sitting around. But when he would get a call, rush to it and all the exciting and adrenaline, mm-hmm. you know, picked up. And then around like, I'd say 4 or 5 in the morning, we'd all call it a night and go home.
I guess in a lot of cases, the media has kind of a bad reputation. People like to sort of point fingers at the media and say, look, you shouldn't be here, or you're acting like vultures. Did you sort of get any sense of that in the course of making this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I see why people think that. And that's something Steve has to fight a lot too, that, you know, that kind of bothers him. But, mostly because the go-to response he has to that is, you know, where were you on 9/11? And, you know, most people were in front of the TV mm-hmm. watching that news coverage. So as much as you want to hate him and as much as you don't, you know, you want to call him names or whatever, you know, you want him there so you can see the news as it unfolds.
Mm-hmm. And what got you into filmmaking?
To be honest, I don't know. I always thought, like, oh, I kind of just fell into it. And I didn't have one of those backstories of being, you know, oh, I've been doing this my whole life, like most people do with their careers. But I remember when I was really little, mm-hmm. I always wanted this digital camera for Christmas. I would want it every year, and then I remember making shorts with my friends, and none of them would take it seriously. I'd be like, come on, guys, this is the most important scene. And they're like, they just wanted to turn everything into a fight. And I was like, no, you got, your characters aren't fighting. And mm-hmm. like a 5 or 6 years old arguing with my friends over the story.
Right. Do you think also that, I guess, you know, filmmaking equipment has become a little cheaper and more easy to access these days. Is that also kind of broadening the pool of people who are actually out there making stuff now?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, especially with YouTube, Vimeo, and things like that. Anybody with a cell phone can be a filmmaker now if they wanted to. There's beautiful-looking films shot with an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need, you know, a high-end camera film to make a film, you know, if you know what you're doing.
Is it a little bit daunting or discouraging, the idea that there is this massive horde of young filmmakers just swarming around and, yeah. and they're all competing for the same piece of pie?
Yeah, I mean, it is scary, but you're going to get that in any industry, anywhere you go, especially, you know, the alternative, moving out to L.A. or back home or something. You know, there's the same amount of people there, if not more.
Well, I've been talking to Stephen Carlson. He's a film student at Full Sail University, and his short film Stringer, which looks at the life of a late-night freelance cameraman, is opening at the Orlando Film Festival this year in the Interesting Characters category. Stephen, thanks very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.